From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. Coming up, the mixed blessings of cell phones and children. They help parents keep track of where their kids are, but what are the kids doing with their mobile devices? Sending text messages and photo sharing, for sure, but what else are they doing? And how involved should parents be in monitoring kids' cell phone use or putting limits on when, where, and what they can do with their mobile devices? And what's the right age for youngsters to get a cell phone anyway? Parents, kids, and cell phones. That's our topic this hour. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Well, it is hard to imagine life without cell phones, right? Checking in with family and friends, staying in touch with work when you're traveling, that's a mixed blessing, and so much more than that. But what about children? What's the right age for kids to get their own cell phone? And what do parents need to teach them about this portable and private world that they're getting into? How are kids using cell phones when they're holed up in their bedrooms or late at night when you think they're asleep? Who are they talking to? What are they sharing? And how do you balance knowing the answers to those questions with privacy? What kinds of rules or boundaries should there be? That is our topic this hour on Forum. Joining us right here with me in the studio is Jim Steyer. He's CEO and founder of Common Sense Media, which is a San Francisco-based nonprofit seeking to improve media and entertainment on behalf of kids and families. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Also joining us by phone, Amanda Lenhart, a senior researcher of director of teens and technology with the Pew Research Center. Good to have you as well.
Glad to be here.
And also Madeline Levine, a Marin psychologist. Her most recent book is Teach Your Children Well, and also co-founder of Challenge Success, an education reform project at Stanford. Good to have you as well.
Hi there.
Let me begin with you, Jim. How big a problem is this for parents?
Well, it's a big reality. It can be a problem if cell phones are used improperly, but the truth is our kids today just live with these devices, and it's dramatically changed their social, emotional, and cognitive development, the way they communicate with each other, and I think oftentimes with us as parents. And again, if used improperly, I think it can be a real problem. That said, if used thoughtfully and with the right kind of guidance, they are here to stay. The genie is out of the bottle, if you will.
And they have an advantage over parents, right? They're digital natives.
They are truly digital natives. You know, it's interesting. I'm the father of four children. And we're pretty conservative because I run Common Sense, obviously, and I read Amanda's research and the Common Sense Media research. I know the data on this stuff, but we're pretty conservative. We don't even let our kids get a cell phone until they finish grade school, until they're about to go to high school. But as a parent, you just see it. Your kids live with these devices, and they are natives. They are different than we are. But if you go out there and look at your colleagues who are our age, Scott, you know, and people over the age of 25, they're glued to their phones as well.
It's a little distressing. Amanda, what does some of the research show in this regard?
Well, we've done some research quite recently that suggests that certainly adoption of mobile phones is quite high amongst young people. Amongst teens 12 to 17, we see that more than 3/4 of them have access to a cell phone. And in just the last year, we've actually seen a remarkable jump in the number of teens who own smartphones. And that really changes the game because certainly having a smartphone in your pocket is a lot different than just having a stick phone. It's really like having a mini computer. And so we also see a big change in the number of teens who we describe as cell mostly, meaning they do most of their internet use on their mobile phone. And that really is often facilitated by having a smartphone. But that's another big change and I think suggests the ways in which mobile is really becoming quite pervasive in teens' lives.
And what are some of the concerns that all this raises?
Well, I think, you know, Jim is the one who I think really handles the concerns part better than we do at the Pew Internet Project. But certainly I think I think makes it more challenging for parents to really have a good sense of how to monitor what their children are doing on the internet. Because when you have this very much more private, smaller device in which you actually have to take sort of different steps to enable technical monitoring solutions and which fewer parents have actually done, it can be harder to really know what your kids are doing on their mobile phone. I think also conversely, when you have a set of kids, and in particular, I'm thinking of kids from low-income families for whom the mobile phone is often their primary and, in fact, only way of getting on the internet. Those kids may not actually have as good access to certain kinds of information because of the ways in which a lot of websites and information aren't optimized for mobile. So there's a little bit of a tension here in that it's in some ways harder for parents to monitor what information their kids are getting access to, but that even on the other side, some kids may not be able to get access to information they want or need because they're using a mobile device.
And Madeline Levine, what are some of the emotional and psychological issues that come up around cell phone use for younger people?
Well, I think, as was just said, that it's really not just cell phone use. Many kids have smartphones. Smartphones are computers, and it introduces them to the entire online world. And I want to start by just saying there are a million good uses, both for the internet and cell phones and stuff like that. That's a given. You know, it's good for some kids. It's good for creativity. It's good for getting information. It's good for staying in touch with family. It can be creative. Kids can pursue hobbies. There's a million good reasons. But I also think that there are a million dangerous reasons, mostly that have to do with the fact that the major job, from my point of view, and I think most psychologists' point of view, of childhood is learning self-control and immersing oneself in friendships. And I think that the color of friendships, the tenor, the tone of friendships is wildly changed by the sort of constant, immediate, non-face-to-face contact that kids have with each other now.
Jim, you're nodding.
I completely agree with Madeline. I think it is a revolution in the way that young people communicate with each other and oftentimes even with their parents. I think teachers know that, parents know it, and I think it has an enormous impact on some of their social relationships because it's very different to be even hearing someone's voice and the inflection of it and understanding the emotional content or lack thereof in a communication than it is via text. Amanda's completely correct, obviously, about the fact that these are mini computers if they're smartphones. So the relationships issues are big. I think we should talk about addiction and attention issues, too, because I think going to Madeline's point, too, when you're constantly stimulated like that, there are real addiction and attention issues. And, of course, privacy is a huge deal.
Yeah. Well, and we'll come back to that. But how does it change the nature of relationships?
Well, I think, again, if you're face-to-face with someone, it's a very different kind of conversation than when you text someone impersonally.
How is it different?
Well, think about, because you have to see their reaction and you have to deal with it. One of the reasons why we've had bullying forever, but cyberbullying became such an issue, or even sexting, is with a click of a keystroke or that little button on your phone, you can send something into space, if you will, where millions of people can see it. It's not the same as if I said something, I'm sitting across from you right now, Scott, if I had to say something to your face that was very painful, it would be hard. Even on the phone, you know, it's interesting. I remember when we were growing up, our parents complained we were on the phone too much. But I'd rather my kids were on the phone a lot of times if there's going to be any kind of meaningful conversation, because you can't detect the emotion involved. And that's a huge deal in terms of empathy and the pros and cons.
Would you agree with that, Madeline, that it changes that the connection that you have with people, and you're maybe saying things in a text or in an email that you wouldn't say, or you wouldn't say it that way, in a way perhaps it's more hurtful?
Well, yeah, Jim and I tend to agree with each other on many on many things. But I think there's one other thing that I think is critically important that hasn't been touched, and that's the intervention of a parent in the necessity of a parental intervention in terms of the development of empathy. So you're with your kid, and your kid says to somebody, you know, you're stupid. And the parent hears it and intervenes and says, well, how do you think that makes your brother feel or your cousin feel or whatever? A parent doesn't have access to that. And so the heartbeat between impulse and action is not stopped, right? It's just so easy to hit that button. There's no intervening variable. And I think that's a big part of the role of parents with not just, you know, the youngest children, but children all the way along the line, which is, how did that make you feel? What was that like? Can you imagine how they felt? None of that is there when a kid, you know, hits the you're fat or I hate you button and sends it out.
We're talking about teens texting online behavior this hour on Forum. And we're going to open the phone lines early because I suspect a lot of people may want to weigh in on this. So give us a call if you're interested. 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org. Tell us how you've dealt with this with your own kids, or perhaps your kids aren't quite old enough to get a cell phone and you're wondering how to roll that out. Amanda, what does the research show in terms of the age at which parents are giving kids their phones? Is it changing? Is it getting younger?
So, Scott, I will answer that question in a second, but I do think we actually have a little bit of data in our work that talks to some of these issues that we've talking about the change in this relationship and the kind of tenor of conversations on technology. And we actually asked teens to tell us about some of these issues around the kinds of disagreements or the utility of this, what we call mediated communication, right, where there's a screen between you and somebody else. And we actually found that teens said that it was a mixed bag. So a lot of the negatives that both Madeline and Jim have been talking about not being able to hear some of the emotional tone of the conversation is a real deal. And teens tell us that that's why they use emoticons. They're very careful about their punctuation because they're worried about how their text is going to be perceived. But on the flip side, they said it was also really helpful for them in having conversations that they were otherwise too afraid to have with somebody else. So it actually empowered them to have some difficult conversations because of the fact that they could in some ways push through the anger of the other person on the other side in ways that was ultimately helpful. So I do think that it's not entirely bad, this mediated nature of the communication. It certainly has challenges, but it's not. And then to your other question around the age at which teens get cell phones, we see that the average teen gets a cell phone either at age 12 or 13. About half of teens at that point have a phone, and basically about 75% of kids have a phone by the time they're 13, and the remaining get them basically when they're 14 or 15. So right around middle school is the time when most families choose to give phones to their kids.
And Jim Starr, what are you hearing from parents about the ways that they're how involved are parents?
It's all over the map, Scott. I mean, the truth is, and Amanda's correct, there are and you heard Madeline say this from the outset, and I'm sure the callers and listeners are going to think this. There's many different aspects to this. This is not a black or white issue. It is a gray area. But boy, parents are all over the map, and how kids use this is all over the map. And I'm sure in our large audience out there, people will disagree and agree depending on what they think is right. I think one other issue I want to bring up, though, is the fact that the photo aspect is huge now. I mean, these kids use their phones constantly to snap pictures of each other. And the downside of that, obviously, is just the obsession with photos and wasting time with photos, let alone sexting or more negative forms. But it's also capturing moments, sharing that with friends on the positive side. I think as a parent, because that's what we're really talking about, I think you have to teach your kids to be respectful, smart, and ethical. I think the ethical issue is critical because this is a different form of communication where ethical norms matter and they've been rewritten. So one of the most important things we are doing now in real time as a society here in the U.S. and globally is redefining the ethics of communications. And that is critical in the context of human relationships.
Go ahead. Is that Madeline? Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say partly to Jim, partly to everybody. It seems to me the biggest problem is we don't have a media literacy program.
True.
So that whatever it's called, Snapchat or this thing that
Snapchat.
Every kid thinks is gone in 3 seconds, and they have absolutely no understanding that it actually isn't gone. It seems to me that starting with the ABCs, if this is going to be the primary form of communication, just like written language has been, then starting in kindergarten with the ABCs, media literacy ought to be part of every school curriculum.
It seems like Jim Steyer, in many ways, the kids could teach the parents.
Well, it's true. But Madeline, just to that point, because this is important, I think, for the audience to understand. So as you know, at Common Sense, we've built a digital literacy and digital citizenship curriculum with Howard Gardner and his colleagues at the Harvard Ed School over the past 3.5 years. It is now in nearly 50,000 schools in the United States. So that's about almost half of all the K-12 schools. So you're absolutely right about the importance of media literacy. I call it digital literacy because it does involve cell phones, Facebook, online platforms, social media platforms, et cetera. the fact that nearly 50% of the schools in the United States have taken our K through 12 curriculum is huge. And you're right, it has to begin at kindergarten, because with the advent of tablets in particular, and parents oftentimes giving their kids access to their own phones or their tablets, kids at 5 and 6 and 7, actually, even if they don't own a device, to Amanda's point about the age, they have access to it. So the issue of digital literacy is paramount. It needs to happen in homes, and it has to happen in every school in the United States.
And what's an appropriate way in which parents can get involved? I showed you, Jim, sure. A friend of mine sent me a 12-point contract that they had their daughter read over, and I presumably developed together, and it has all kinds of rules and regulations and understandings. Does that seem like a good way to maybe develop it together, sit down with your kid and do that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the key to anything like this that has such a game-changer impact on your relationship with your child and their development, the more dialogue and ongoing communication you have, the better, period. You have to have conversations about it. And the technology is, you know, we just mentioned Snapchat. It changes, so you got to keep up with it. But I love this example from your friend, Scott, that you showed me, because it goes to the heart of stuff. I mean, it's talking about being feuding. Nothing is ever private on the internet. It's talking about no swearing or vulgar language or flaming other people. I actually think that kind of sit down on an ongoing basis with your kids is critical. Also, use of pornography or access to pornography, you know, and I love the final line is the device, you control it, it doesn't control you. That is an incredibly important conversation to have with kids. And I think you can do that as early as 9 or 10 now. And as a parent, this is part of parenting 101 today, whether we like it or not. And honestly, at Common Sense, we do this on the consumer platform and in every school, because this is a reality that is reshaping childhood.
Jim Steyer with Common Sense Media joining us this hour, along with Amanda Lenhart from Pew Research, the Pew Research Center, on recently doing a study on teens and technology, their 2013 report now available, and Madeline Levine, a Marin psychologist, whose most recent book is Teach Your Children Well. We've got a lot of callers here, so I want to start bringing them into the conversation. Let's begin in San Jose, and Nona is on the line. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
Well, I'm 28, and I grew up with some of the precedents for this. I feel like my generation was sort of the generation that practiced with this stuff. I had AOL Instant Messenger. Later in my teens, I had texting. And I'm totally normal and totally fine. I don't think we just went from talking on the phone to constantly texting. I think Instant Messenger, I was on all night, you know, hours and hours and stuff and sometimes. And I grew up to be totally normal. And
But given yes, given what you know about all that now, I don't know if you have kids, but if and when you have kids, based on your own experience, what kinds of limitations would you put, or how would you educate your kids about how to use those devices?
Well, I mean, my parents always said, don't go online when you're supposed to be in bed. And of course, I would say the same thing, but sometimes you can't control your kid. And I put limits on myself. I would be online, you know, at midnight and be like, okay, I have a test tomorrow. Like, I'm going to get off. Like, kids are not totally stupid.
Did you obey your parents when they said don't use it at night?
No, I mean, obviously not. But
obviously
also,
not.
But I mean, I also had a little bit of self-control. And I think that, you know, obviously you have to instill these values of having self-control. But, you know, kids are going to do what they want. And I don't believe in trying to monitor their usage very, very closely. They'll just resent you.
Well, Madeline Levine, let me bring you in on that question. What's an appropriate level of involvement of parents?
I think it depends. Look, it depends on the child, and it depends on the child's age. And I just want to get one thing out there, Scott, which we'll come back to later. I think the real issue is with parental use of cell phones more than it is with kids' use of cell phones, but that's a diversion. Maybe we'll get to it.
You mean around their kids or just in general?
What I see in my office is kids who feel neglected, parents who wait for their children at school and somebody has to knock on the door because they're busy texting and they don't even know that their kid has walked out of school, people who say to me, I know I'm supposed to be with my kids, but that's, you know, the BlackBerry is in the background and I can't concentrate, I can't be present. I did a seminar down in Silicon Valley for a bunch of, you know, the Silicon Valley crowd, and they were not willing to give up their cell phone, not for dinner, not for dates, not to be with their children, you know.
Yeah,
now, this isn't everybody, but if I was going to pick what I think is the biggest issue, it would be that.
Yeah, interesting.
And I just want to throw that.
Throw that out there. No, you see, sometimes moms or dads, kids in the stroller, and they're walking down the sidewalk, and they're looking at their phones, and their kids are looking up. They want some interaction, and the parent's busy.
This is a huge deal. Madeline is completely correct, and I'm sure that Amanda's best-of-class research would show this, too. This is a huge deal. And actually, as a parent, the number one thing you can do is model good behavior and unplug yourself. Madeline is completely correct. We have a colleague that all of us know well, Sherry Turkle. She wrote a great book called Alone Together, which says that the title says a lot of it. As a parent, it's amazing how parents become disconnected from their parenting responsibilities and from their children and aren't present for them, as Madeline said. Now, going back to what the caller said about she's normal. I believe she's normal. And by the way, for everybody out there, your kids are going to grow up normal. We're not, none of us are saying this as if it's all, the world is coming to an end or it's terrible. We're just saying, boy, this has a huge impact on our children and ourselves. And Madeline is right. The first thing you have to do is look in the mirror and look at your own behavior with devices and change it and unplug. We must unplug. You know, we live in the most beautiful place in the world, the Bay Area. You go out on the beach, you go out in the mountains, and there are these people glued to their phones. You want to go, have you ever thought about looking at the natural wonder around you rather than...
And it's not just phones. I mean, it's other... I mean, you see people in museums, you know, and they're videotaping every picture to bring home to people. And it's like, be in the moment, you know? It's.
I totally agree.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Catherine in Sebastopol, welcome.
Hello. I just wanted to mention that I have older kids and younger kids, and one of the things that I noticed for my youngest is that he has anxiety because he doesn't understand how to filter this. He got all upset about the end of the world thing. He was 10 years old, and now he can distinguish all the different gangsta signs. So we got a picture of my my sheltered niece for Easter, and she had put her fingers up, which turned out to be the West LA gangsta sign of a W as a funny thing. And he spotted it right away. He's like, oh, why is she putting up a gangsta sign for her Easter picture? And, you know, these are things that are real to him because he can get them in his bed at night and he can look at them and he can see what the rappers are doing. And parents have to understand that that has an impact when you're 10, 11, 12, 13
sure.
years old.
Sure. Well, Madeline Levine, there isn't, I mean, like you said, someone said earlier, even if you don't have a phone, you have access to these devices, and it's much harder for parents to control the information that their kids have.
Right. And I, you know, it needs to be a conversation. I appreciate the point that, look, it's the Nona who said, you know, I'm not nuts and I have relationships. And Jim sort of confirming that, look, for most kids, there will be adaptations and there will be changes in the way people communicate. And some of that will be for the good and some of that won't be. But at the end of the day, you have to know your child incredibly well. You have to know what makes them anxious. You have to know what smooths their ability to communicate. There is no substitute for knowing your child deeply and then making decisions, you know, coupled with the kinds of research that Amanda's doing and then making your decisions. But there is no one-size-fits-all.
Catherine, thanks for the call, and we'll have much more coming up in the second half of the hour. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. And, of course, you can email your comments and questions to KQED, forum@kqed.org, and you can also go to our Facebook page as well. Lots more about teens and technology coming up. I'm Scott Schaefer. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer here this morning. And this hour, we're talking about teens, texting, online behavior, all of those things. Our guests, Jim Steyer, CEO and founder of Common Sense Media, also Amanda Lenhart. She's a senior researcher and the director of digital teens and technology at Pew Research. And Madeline Levine, a Marin psychologist, co-founder of Challenge Success, an education reform project at Stanford University. 866-733-6786 is the number. 866-733-6786. 833-6786. And Jim, during the break, we were talking about the responsibility of the industry, the cell phone industry, the technology industry. Should they be involved in some way in what exactly?
Oh, I think this is a huge issue. I believe here we are in the Bay Area, the home of Silicon Valley. You know, I'm a prof at Stanford. Madeline's Talent Success Program came out of Stanford. Amanda, even though she's back east, she knows it well. This is the home of the valley of the tech industry. And basically, as this extraordinary changes have happened because of the great talents of Silicon Valley and now San Francisco, radio silence from the industry, radio silence. Now, I believe a lot of it is because there's sort of a libertarian engineering mentality, which is we are creating the coolest, fastest devices that enable you to aggregate data. But in truth, these are fundamentally impactful issues in our society for kids, obviously, but for adults. And I don't – it's surprising if you think of other platforms like television or movies. There has at least been – because they've been around for longer, people have looked at the pros and cons, the extraordinary, wonderful sides of it, just like we have with the technology devices, but also the downsides. The industry – radio silence. Many of them are too young to have – they haven't gotten married and have kids in many cases, or they don't want to deal with the downside.
What would you like to see them do?
Oh, my God. I think, for example, the digital literacy and citizenship curriculum we were talking about earlier, and Madeline said it should be every school in the country. Come on. The tech industry ought to be financing that. On privacy issues, which are enormous, we have a data arms race today between Google, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, the big players here, right? Aggregate data at warp speed. Damn the consequences, excuse my language. But the truth is, there are enormous impacts on society, pro and con. And I think the industry should be stepping up to the plate in two ways. One, making the public aware of the pros and cons. And two, funding the research. Amanda runs one of the major research programs in the United States. Common Sense has a kids and media research program with our colleague Vicky Rideout. And there's no research. We're conducting the biggest experiment on our kids in warp time. And without Pew, we wouldn't have any research. Why isn't the industry spending some of their wonderful gains on research on child development, emotional, social development, cognitive development?
Well, let me invite them to call in. I'm sure some are listening. Give us a call, 866-733-6786. And let's go to the phones now. William is on the line down there in Silicon Valley, Palo Alto. Welcome.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I just wanted to say I'm bothered by the value that we assign to different forms of communication. It seems like there's always this automatic assumption that new forms of communication are more dangerous. And I think we need to be very, very cautious how we find a way to talk about the dangers of something without necessarily qualifying one form as more dangerous than another or better for people than another. I certainly understand the benefits of a face-to-face conversation, but by the same token, if I only have face-to-face conversations, if that's how I learn to relate to people, the people I know are the people in my neighborhood and my school, and that's the limit of my experiences. I'll never talk to somebody in India or China or any other place in the world if I don't have these tools that enable me to reach out. And in particular, I'm bothered by the idea that all the dangers that our children are facing are the dangers of these forms of communication. I mean, certainly there's a lot of things that go on and they have to be addressed. But for every person who is subject to some form of abuse because of something that happened via the internet and pictures and something like that, there's another person out there who is subject to a very private and terrible form of abuse that, because of the advent of communications technologies, found a way to reach out and found help somehow.
Sure, and let me just bring
ourselves harm, I think, when we assume that the new form is worse than the old.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And Jim, I think what we're saying here is that there are just – because it's new, there are ramifications that haven't necessarily been thought of and need to be discussed with your kids.
But our caller's point is excellent. And Madeline or Amanda, if you want to jump in, that's a really – I agree with what he just said. I don't think any of us are trying to paint it in that way. And he's correct that – With new tools, people get a little you get scared at the beginning, and we become. But yeah. I think he's making really important points.
Yeah.
There.
Amanda, go ahead.
I'm going to back up against it a little bit because what we do, there are things we do know about early child development. It's the reason why baby Einstein ends up retarding language acquisition as opposed to propelling it forward, and that's that kids. And I don't believe this changes. Kids learn through their sensorium. They learn through attachment. And if you get in the way of attachment with young children, I think we are going to see some significantly negative outcomes. Now, that's for real young children. And just like Jim said, you know, every place I go in this country to speak, and that's practically every place in this country, there's always concerns and questions about technology. And the answer always has to be, we don't know enough yet.
Yeah.
That really does need to be changed.
Amanda, were you trying to jump in?
Yeah, and I just wanted to add in that that William from Palo Alto brings up a great point, as Jim has said. And actually, there's actually a bunch of research that looks at previous technologies and the ways in which we had real difficulty and struggles with them. I mean, just people were terrified when we had cars become widespread because it would allow young people to go on dates outside of the view of their family. Mm-hmm. The same thing about phones. Many families initially installed phones in their home in outbuildings because they didn't want the ringing of and the disruption of external communication to violate the sanctity of the home. So, you know, we've struggled with how to bring technologies into our lives for many, many years, and I think the internet is just and technology and mobile phones are just the next step,
the latest version of
this
iteration of this
difficulty.
William, thanks so much for the call. Let's go now to Burlingame. Bryce is on the line. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'll be brief. I had two questions. The first is, I often hear the statistic that like 80% of communication is nonverbal. So I'm curious what the impact is on all this digital communication and whether kids who are growing up with it are developing strategies to fill in that gap. And second, I forgot my second point. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. Madeline, you want to make a comment about the nonverbal communication aspect of this?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that learning to read another person accurately is a critical life skill. At NYU 2 years ago, for their incoming freshman class, they had a seminar called Virtual Facebook because they felt that kids were more facile online than they were in person. And so they had this little curriculum of teaching people what it meant to poke somebody in real life, which was just like stick out your hand, make eye contact, and say, how are you? And I may be on the more alarmist side, but I do think that without adequate practice, without attachment, and you cannot be attached when you're on your, you know, BlackBerry and your kid is sitting in the stroller wet or crying or something, you can't be attached. And without the capacity to actually be present and reading somebody, there's something to be lost. Now, it may be that these kids end up with two skill sets, but in terms of young children, I have some fairly significant concerns.
On the other hand, Jim Starr, yesterday I Skyped with my niece and nephew in Kenya and Spain.
Well, that
and,
was
and
William's
met
point.
My nephew's girlfriend for the first time.
But that was William's point, which is true, which is now because of these extraordinary new tools and technologies that, again, Silicon Valley in most cases have given us. You have the ability to communicate with people via Skype all around the world, see stuff. So the benefits are extraordinary. But the point, though, is this is a huge change. I don't believe this is the same as just other technologies. You know, my colleague at Harvard, Howard Gardner, who both Amanda and Madeline know well, who's really wonderfully wise educational thinker and researcher, called this – he compares this to the printing press. So – this is not a minor change. I don't believe this is just another technology platform.
It's a revolution.
I believe digital media is a revolution. There are extraordinary positives and benefits. There are enormous challenges. And I think we have to have an ongoing dialogue. But I do say that on the social impact issues, the silence from Silicon Valley is still deafening. They need to come out and lead on this because they're parents too, and they are creating these extraordinary new platforms, but we got to balance the look at them.
Let's read some email here. Hussam from San Jose writes, is it better to let your kids have smartphones at an early age, say 11, and teach them how to be responsible while you can talk to them? If you did give your kids the smartphone at late teenage years, 15 or older, you won't be able to talk to them. Tom, or Jim, rather, you said you do that.
Well, I have a 15-year-old today. Get out of here. I got three teenagers. You can talk to them at 15. You can talk to them at 16, 17. I don't know.
They may
personally
not talk
believe
back.
They at least grunt monosyllabic answers to you. But no, I actually think that the value in delay is that you have the chance to have that conversation. And, you know, we always used to say at commonsense.org that we should have a point in the website called You're the Only Parent Who. because kids say that to you all the time. You know, you're the only parent that doesn't allow me to do this, doesn't allow me. But I think the delay factor is great because it allows you to have the conversation. And again, going back to Madeline's point about role modeling by parents themselves, which is so critical to this. If you delay, then kids can ask you, well, you know, you're too addicted to your crackberry, mommy or daddy. How about your own usage? So I believe that delay is good. And I do believe that one of the things about teenagers, as many of the folks out there in the audience have teens know, you can have conversations with them about this because they may be silent about a lot of stuff, but they will talk to you about their technology and their phones.
Especially if you try to put limits on
exactly. it. Exactly. But it's an incredibly important discussion, and it gets into really important issues of social-emotional relationships.
All right. Let's go back to the phones now. Berkeley, Liz is on the line. Welcome. Good morning.
Hey, thank you so much.
Sure.
I want to preface this. First of all, thank you so much for having this conversation. It's terrific. I want to just preface it by saying I think that the internet and technology is amazing, and I agree with Skyping and international connections. I think it's very powerful, so it's not to take that away at all. I have a child who is high-functioning Asperger's, which is now considered on the spectrum, and she's 8 years old. She has a younger brother who's 7, and we're very strict about technology. And I have to say, one of the things that I've really noticed with her development is she's continually moved forward and is with her peers or beyond in certain areas. And one of the things that's been really interesting is by limiting the technology, it has really put up front social skills. She's a social skills group. She has to learn to talk to people in their eyes, shake their hand, be involved, learn skills with language, how to be a friend. And all of those have been incredibly profound in keeping her connected. Where, you know, the other side is she could, which she loves to watch films, she likes animated films, she could do that all day long easily because it's safe, it's comfortable.
Sure.
We're now moving into films with real people.
Yeah.
but I think it's changed her path because technology will be a skill for her, and a tool. That's how we use it in our family.
Yeah.
It's a tool, but it doesn't take place of playing and out in nature.
And Madeline Levine, that's certainly something that could apply to all kids.
Well, yes, it is. And Liz, is it?
Yes.
Liz made a really good point when she talked about the fact that it's an alternative. It is a choice. It's not the default in the house. And I think a lot of my concern has to do with this has become a default way of communicating and not a good one. And Jim, to your point about whether you wait or not, again, we don't have the research on it, so this is pure speculation. But in terms of child development, everything benefits from a little bit of a wait.
Yeah.
So your child has sex at 13, they're at risk. They have sex at 16, they're not at risk. Your child smokes dope at 14, he's at risk. He waits till 16, he's not at risk. You know, adolescence was always considered a period, a moratorium in Eric Erickson's phrase, and it was a period of great development. And if you have to err on one side or the other, I think you err on a conservative side just because we don't know enough.
Although I'm sure some parents are thinking, 16, I don't want my kid having sex at 16, or like, good luck with that.
I'm just giving you the facts.
Okay. Liz, thanks so much for sharing the story about your daughter.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much.
All right. Take care. Good luck. Let's see here. I've got a lot of email. Let me see if I can find one or two more to read. Anita writes, could your guest address boys and access to porn and how to avoid it on cell or smartphones? That's from Anita.
Huge deal. Yeah. It's a huge deal. Let's not kid ourselves. That said, I am not panicked by this at all as the father of two boys, but it's out there. It's almost.
Would it be different if you had girls?
No, because I think it's there but I think boys are more likely to go searching for it. But Amanda would know the data on that, but I think so. I think the issue is this. You know, there are all sorts of filters out there, et cetera. We rate them all at Common Sense Media, but truthfully, it's an issue. I mean, you know, the great late Neil Postman, the NYU professor, said that childhood should be a sequence of revealed secrets. It's a wonderful way to think about childhood. And I would suggest to you that in the 24/7 digital media world that we're now raising our kids in, a sequence of revealed secrets is mighty tough. So you do have to deal with stuff. And kids can encounter with one typed number or letter wrong, porn and other stuff that you just didn't want to have to deal with. So that's a big deal. And it, again, calls for communication and dialogue.
Amanda, what does the research show about that?
Well, you know, it's really difficult to ask children about their porn use in phone surveys. So we haven't asked directly about how whether young people are doing this. We've certainly asked about lying about your age to access access a website, which can be either saying that you're, you know, 13 when you're 11 to access Facebook, or it can also be saying that you're substantially older to access adult content. And we see, you know, a decent number of teens doing this. About 15% will tell us that they've done this. That's pretty comparable to the number of adults who will actually cop to doing that as well. So, you know, I don't think those numbers are necessarily telling us what kind of a problem it really is. But certainly I think there are monitoring software and blocking software you can put both on, you can put on your computer, and things you can enable on a mobile phone. But it's a challenge. And for every, I do a lot of focus groups. In fact, I've just come from doing a bunch of them. And every focus group I'm in, there's always at least one child who spends some time sharing how they get around all the filters, all the blocking in their school, at their home. It's a little bit of an arms race, and kids are creative and they're smart. And a subset of them will figure out how to get around whatever it is you put in front of them and then tell all their friends how to do it.
Jim, sir.
The one thing I would add, though, if we're talking about porn, is the concept that kids self-reveal today before they self-reflect. So that in a world where porn is so easily accessed, this is what in some ways can in some cases encourage sexting and provocative posting, that and even on a Snapchat where they think it's going to disappear, but it doesn't really disappear. So the self-reveal before you self-reflect tendencies of teenagers, and, you know, Madeline, being the great psychologist she is, brought up Eric Erickson and the moratorium issue of teenager. And we have more time, we could talk about that. But the truth is, this is an enormous challenge. And in a world where everything is available, which has many positives, as William and other callers have mentioned, the other thing, though, it does is encourages the kids to make very poor decisions. And when everything is replicable, and when there is no eraser button out there, and when the industry has repeatedly resisted our calls to create an eraser button and to create technology that would allow you to erase stupid mistakes you made as a teenager or even as an adult, but certainly as a teen or preteen, then we actually...
You're talking about Facebook, that kind of thing?
I think all of the major tech companies have a responsibility here. And by the way, they're led by really thoughtful, good people in most cases. But we need to see far greater responsibility, because I do believe we are conducting the greatest experiment in my lifetime on our kids and teens in real time, with the exception of Amanda and maybe the research that we're able to finance, very little research on what this all means. And so I do believe these are enormously important issues, and that privacy is a big deal as well.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the phones. Jane in San Jose, welcome. Good morning.
Oh, hi. Am I on the air?
You are.
This is Jean, actually, and I volunteer in my children's classroom. I have a kindergartner and a third grader, and we do a Project Cornerstone, and I really wanted to talk about that because I understand there's a digital citizenship connection there.
Uh-huh.
And I'd be really interested to hear more about the digital citizenship program that speakers are talking about.
Yeah.
But particularly they do... when we go into the classroom, once a month. We talk from kindergarten on about values and asset building and ways that we can help prevent bullying in the classroom and on the playground and at home. And then we send that information home. We help the teachers to try and talk about that in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
But in particular, there is a digital citizenship part of it, too, that kind of extends for the older grades. And I believe that this actually goes on into middle school as well, but I don't know how many parent volunteers are actually doing it in the middle schools. But we're in the San Jose Unified, and it's a parent-run organization, so it's provided for by the PTA.
Yeah. Jim Starr?
We give it a Common Sense created a K-12 digital citizenship, digital literacy curriculum. I am proud to say I have nothing to do with it personally in creating it. I am so proud of it. It is state of the art. We give it away to schools. I'll bet you the school that you're referring to uses the Common Sense curriculum. It does need to start in kindergarten. We give it, it's modular. Depending on the age of kids, obviously, the content changes. But it is all the rules of the road you need. And it should be in every school in the United States. We give it away for free. You can go to commonsense.org and download it. And schools sign up at the rate of $1,000 a month now. Wow. To do it. We give it away because it should be there.
Yeah, Jane, thanks very much for the call. You know, we talked about cyberbullying, and it isn't just the kids with the phones bullying their peers. It could be you could send something out, a photo of yourself, for example, and you could become the subject of the bullying or the rumors or whatever it might be, the cyber attacks, right? I mean, it's really – parents need to protect their kids from that as well. It's not just that they're necessarily out there participating in the bullying.
You know, you just said something really important, Scott, which is – well, you've said a lot of important things. But this idea that Jim keeps bringing up about why are we willing to conduct this experiment on our children. I live in Marin County, and when my kids are out of the house now, but when they were younger, they sprayed Alar on the apples in my community, and every single woman in this community was out at Safeway picketing because we didn't want anything toxic near our children. And it is stunning to me, regardless of whether you think technology is a great idea and cell phones are a great idea or not such a great idea, they do, in fact, displace a whole array of other activities. And it seems to me that in that displacement, there are things that are happening. And so I'll refrain from saying whether I think they're good things or bad things, but they do displace other activities for kids. And the fact that we are willing to participate in this on our kids, what Jim is calling the greatest social experiment of our lives, is kind of stunning to me.
Yeah. We talked to
I'd just like to ask this to go ahead, Amanda, back for just a little bit of a second and think a little bit about the context of our lives today and the ways in which that may be actually driving some of this desire to use the technology. I mean, think about the ways in which our children's lives are kind of physically circumscribed. Many youth today aren't able to go outside and play as much as they used to because parents are worried about the safety of their neighborhoods. They're worried about children being snatched. We have a little bit of a culture of fear around our children and having them kind of out of our sight. And that really, and children desire interaction with other kids and other people. They want to. In our studies, they tell us their preferred mode of interaction with people is face-to-face, but often they can't really do that. So they move to these digital interactions and these digital spaces of interaction to actually fulfill that need for human interaction with peers and to develop those kinds of relationships.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we're vilifying parents to a certain degree for spending a lot of time with the Crackberry, as it were, their iPhone. But we also have to interrogate business culture that tells parents that you have to be 24/7 available to your job and the ways in which, you know, we don't have a culture that's particularly family friendly in a business environment and requires people to be on in that way. And so that, you know, their trade-off is I go to the game, but I do so by having the BlackBerry in my pocket so my boss can call me. That's how I kind of manage this. So I think we need to give parents a little bit of a break in the ways in which they're trying to manage some of their different tensions in their lives using the technology to try to make it work.
What about, Jim Steyer, what about the connection between all this and attention deficit?
Well, it's a big deal. But by the way, amen, Amanda. Those are really good points. I completely agree with you. And again, for the listener out there, we are not vilifying technology. This is here. The genie's out of the bottle, and we embrace it. I mean, common sense, and I know Madeline and Amanda agree. We are embracing this, but we are saying this is a huge deal. We must
deal. Control it rather than being controlled.
And you've got to look at the good stuff and not the not so good stuff. And sometimes people listen to this and they think we're just being critical. We're not. We're saying this is a huge deal. We have to accept it. The attention issues are enormous. I mean, Amanda probably knows the research better than I do, but I remember in my book, Talking Back to Facebook, I wrote a whole chapter about this is your kid's brain on computers. There is no question that digital media affects your kid's attention. And if you have a kid who's already susceptible to ADD or ADHD, they can increase that. Again, they are stimulating a different part of the brain, the impulse part of the brain. And you can just look at yourself as an adult or other people to know that there are real attention issues here because you can't multitask. One of my colleagues at Stanford, Cliff Nass, one of the really fine researchers in the field, has done fascinating research that shows, with Roy P., also a great Stanford professor, that multitasking is a myth. So I worry in my job at Stanford, which is not my regular job, I don't think kids write as well, for example. I don't think they can concentrate. I ban laptops in my class, by the way, because I don't believe they can pay attention to lecture and the discussion because they're distracted. So I think the attention distraction issues are enormous. And in some cases, they clearly lead to compulsive and addictive behavior. So this is another area where research is critical. I am not a PhD in this field, but it seems like a no-brainer to understand that there are enormous attention and addiction issues that are involved here.
Madeline Levine, anything you want to add about that?
I'd like to hear Amanda's response.
Amanda?
So, you know, Jim's right. There's very little research on it. There's a few pieces that have been done in, you know, two Chinese high schools. So very little, I think, broad-based applicable work on these topics. And it's tough because how do you – there's some disagreement about how to define addiction, whether it applies to internet use. And so I do think this is certainly a new area. I absolutely 100% agree with Jim. The research suggests there's no such thing as multitasking. It's more like quick switching between tasks and – kids are a bit better at it than adults, but they're not perfect. So it certainly is something that's a challenge, and we certainly need to do more research on these topics.
Final thoughts. We're short on time, but maybe resources. Where can parents go, Jim Sarr? Obviously,
well,
your website.
I'm so proud of Common Sense. I have very little to do with anything that we do anymore. I think commonsense.org, I am so proud of my colleagues, what the resources they've created for parents, the resources we've created for hopefully half and hopefully someday soon all of the schools in the United States. So, I mean, I would go to commonsense.org, but I would go to if you want the research, Amanda's stuff at Pew is outstanding. Madeline, I would have to say, is, you know, one of the great psychologists in the United States on this stuff. So it's out there. But we tried to create commonsense.org as a one-stop shop. So you can find anything you need, and you decide what you think is right for your kid. We are not preaching or telling you right or wrong.
All right. And then it's going to have to be the last word. I'm sure we'll also, fair to say, Judy Campbell, we'll have some links on our website as well for some of these things. So check that out, too. Thanks to all of you for listening. Great comments and calls. We appreciate that. And thanks to our guests, of course, Jim Steyer from Common Sense Media, Amanda Lenhart, Director of Teens and Technology at Pew Research, and Madeline Levine, a psychologist up in Marin, author of Teach Your Children Well. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Susan Britton, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny, who returns tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.